I went to Concordia Austin for high school and junior college. I was in the first junior college class they ever had. And that was right during the middle of the Korean conflict. And I think the one decision that I made by the time I finished with college is that at the moment I did not want to be a pastor. And so I did not come to St. Louis. And within just a few days after that, I had a draft notice. And so I went down originally to the post office to talk to the people in the Navy, and they were out for lunch. For the Marine Corps guy talked me into signing up. And I spent the next 7 years then in the Marine Corps. I started out as an enlisted man, but ended up as a Marine pilot. Did my carrier landings, and then specialized in flying helicopters. I flew helicopters for 4 years. After a lot of that took place in Hawaii. Then Arlene and I came back to California. And when I got out of the service, I went into banking in my home in New Mexico. But found myself constantly being drawn back to church work and being drawn back to my Lord. And in 1964, we went to the Lay Training Institute in Milwaukee. And we finished there in 1966, and were called to the McGinnis Field as evangelistic missionaries. My whole time in McGinnis was not always completely in evangelism, but a good portion of it was. And as happens, you always end up evangelizing. You always end up speaking about that which lies within you. I came back to the States, and in 1977, I had a call to the Nebraska District to serve for them as mission developer. In 1977, I started a congregation in Lincoln, Nebraska. In 1979, I started a congregation in Gretna, Nebraska. Between 79 and 81, while working on the congregation in Gretna, I was involved on a part-time basis in another new mission start that had started in Palmyra, Nebraska. And then in 1981, I started another mission back in Lincoln. And I came here in February of this year. When you check statistics as to periods of growth within our Missouri Synod, you see that the immediate high number-wise for people is in 1950. But when you look back 100 years before, into the middle 1800s, and not that much after our Church Fathers of the Missouri Synod came here, I think in the number of new congregations on a percentage basis, that was probably the highest period that we've ever had. Of course, if you've only got two congregations 1 year and the next year you've got four, you've just increased by 100%. And we presently are in the 6,000s, and to have 100% growth, we would have to have 12,000. So, you know, you can play all kinds of games with numbers. But the need is still there. The reason for starting new congregations hasn't changed. Now, I mentioned before that I was hired and given a call by the Nebraska District as a missionary developer. We need to spend just a few moments on this. The normal thing that districts do when they want to start a congregation, and there are many ways of starting a congregation. It can be done on a mother-daughter relationship. It can be done by a district. simply going into a brand new area where there is no mother or no circuit help. It can be done in other ways as well. Possibly a circuit could go together and give birth to a new daughter congregation. But most of the time within our church, districts have hired or asked people to be missionaries at large. I'm not sure of the background of this terminology, but I know how the job works. The gentleman, and quite frequently he's a candidate from the seminary, is given a map and said, maybe a new congregation here, the Lord bless you. And that's about it. My situation was very similar. They said, there's a piece of property in Southeast Lincoln that we bought 10 years ago, and we want you to go build a church down there. Okay. About my second week there, I went to look at the piece of property, which nobody had looked at in the previous 10 years, and we found out that there's over 1,000 cubic yards of dirt missing from this 10 acres of land, and that when they built the new shopping center in Lincoln, that there was a large hole under Sears parking lot, and somebody went up there and helped themselves and hauled off 1,000 cubic yards of dirt. And so here, what the district could own for 10 years without knowing it was a hole in the ground, really. things happen. But that first congregation, we started out by worshiping in a warehouse. From there, we bought a chicken farm because we made the people take the hole in the ground back. We then bought a chicken farm, and we got a good price on it, and the location was pretty good. But here's all these old buildings where they had had chickens laying eggs. And what in the world are we going to do with that? So we priced it out, and the cheapest we could get was about a $7,000 bid is what it would cost us for somebody to tear it down. So we put our thinking cap on, and we called the fire department, and we said, you guys want some practice in burning some buildings? Oh, we'd love it. Thrilled to death. And so the fire department came out there 3 Saturdays in a row and would set fire to one building, put it out, set fire to it again, put it out, set fire to it again, put it out. And you wouldn't believe the publicity that we got in the paper and on the TV. And I saw to it that, that this was going to be the future home of the Shepherd. I was there for about a year with those people. Then I went on to Gretna. Gretna was a little different. We had the facilities of the basement of the town hall. Very nice facilities. That one took a little bit longer. I was with them for about 2 years. What I'm talking about here is a basic definition of mission developer, where the individual who goes says to the congregation ahead of time, I'll work with you for a period of time, and at that time we want you to call a pastor. Don't call me, because I'm a mission developer, and I'm going to keep going on to the next one and to the next one and to the next one. The thinking behind this is all of us are bound to learn something by our mistakes. We're not going to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. And eventually, you're going to have somebody who knows something about starting a new congregation. Now, the missionary at large learns, because he will make his mistakes, and with the Lord's help, he'll do things that are right and that allow for good, healthy growth within the congregation. But probably 90% of the time, when the congregation becomes a member of the synod, they give the call to the man. That's fine, and he stays there. And whatever knowledge he may have gained, whatever insights into starting new congregations he may have gained, might die with it, because he may never start another congregation again in his life. On the other hand, some do. Now, there are some problems with this. The people that I worked with became very close to me. And it was really very early in their congregational life to be getting rid of one person and picking up a new person. But they overcame it most of the time. The third congregation in the Highlands area of Lincoln was a little bit different, and here again, this was a real struggle. 1,500 people in a housing subdivision in the northwest corner of Lincoln. No churches there at all. Full of what I refer to as first house or first home families. And I'll explain that a little later. And a real beckoning place to start a congregation. By this time, the city of Lincoln had some housing laws, and we had what you always look for is a place to meet and a place to worship. In this area were 550 houses, and that was it. No school buildings, no stores, absolutely nothing but houses. So we thought about renting a house or buying a house, but the city said, no, you can't do that. Using it as a place of public worship. It has to be so many feet away from the next door neighbors. You have to have X amount of parking space for each 10 square foot of the main meeting area. The floors are not strong enough in the type of homes that are built in that area to hold more than what the people would normally have in their house. We ran into all kinds of problems. We thought about bringing in a double-wide trailer, but there again, the city said, you've got to put a permanent foundation under it, you've got to supply gas, you've got to supply electricity, and you've got to supply a sewer hookup. So this one was a real challenge, and I went to the board of directors and said, I need between $80,000 and $100,000 to buy some property and build the first phase of a building. They said, but you don't have a congregation yet. I said, no, I don't. That's right. But I'm going to turn this one around. Let's have the building first, then we'll get the congregation. Well, you can imagine, you know, what was that? You want $100,000 to build a building for a congregation that you hope to put into it. The success part of the story on that building is 8 months after we started having services there. That congregation went to the district and said, we're now ready for permission to borrow some money to build the second phase of that building. And they said, definitely out of the question. And the congregation said to the board, if you do us a favor and you board members come to at least one Sunday service before you make a decision. They did that, and within 2 months, they had permission to go ahead with the second unit. So this is the difference in comparing a missionary at large to a mission developer. Are you the type of individual that is ready to move every 2 years or less? Can you plan on that, you know, with yourself and with your family? Are you able to, as you're knocking on doors and getting to know these people in these congregations, and I mean really get to know them, you've never been closer to people than you are when you're in a mission congregation. As you're meeting them, can you get rid of the thought that's in the back of your mind that in a year or two I've got to say goodbye to you? This is difficult. Is the mission developer concept the way to go? Is the worker priest mission developer concept the way to go? The growth that within our church right now is a lot lower than it was. What I keep hearing today is we can't start new congregations. We don't have enough money. This is a bad economic time. maybe what we really need to do is have larger congregations. The greatest battle that I fought was not with with the unholy three, the devil, the world, and our flesh. It was with the circuit pastors. Why in the world do you want to start another congregation in this circuit? In a seven-year period, I started two congregations in the Lincoln Circuit, and they had eight when I got there. And I was not well received, not by any stretch of the imagination. You're going to steal all our members. And yet, in working in that circuit and in checking some statistics, I found out that two of the churches in their history had started daughter churches, and in their entire, one congregation was 25 years old, one congregation was 80 years old, in their entire history, the greatest year of growth was the year that they started daughter congregations. Because the people as a congregation were actually involved. And sure, some of their people that were their members were actually transferred to the daughter congregation, but if 50 members were transferred during that year at the birth of that daughter congregation, they gained 100 or 150, which they have never equaled before that or since that day. Because, see, church growth says to us that if you're not growing, you're dying. And biological growth doesn't count, and that's 7%. Every congregation should increase by 7% every year simply from having babies. If you're a normal congregation and if you've got the normal age group. So why should we start new congregations? Well, let me tell you why I'm involved in it. I've never in my life, and you might find this hard to believe, I've never been a member of a congregation that's had feet. From the day I was born, I have always been a member of a mission congregation. I don't know what to do with feet. I know what to do with folding chairs. I don't know what to do with pews. I think where I really got started in this whole thing is when Arlene and I were in Hawaii. And how many of you know Mark Bangert, fourth-year student? Mark's dad was starting a new congregation in Hawaii. And went there in 1954. Arlene and I got there in 1955. And we were very active in that congregation. Saw Mark the other day and had the first chance to talk to him, and I said, I can remember your baptism, Mark. I was there. And this set him back a bit. Mark's dad passed away about 2 years ago, I think. But their first son, which was Mark, and our first son, which was Mark, and the name of the congregation was St. Mark. Mark is now in his fourth year in the ministry. My Mark is a pastor in the Australian Lutheran Church. So, you know, it's a small world when you start tying all these beginnings back together. Anyway, why am I involved in new churches? Just before I go to sleep at night, and not every night, but quite frequently, Arlene and I have devotions. 28 years ago, in my premarital counseling to Arlene, the pastor said to us, he said, do me a favor and start your marriage off by having family devotions, at least for the two of you. Maybe on later on with the children, you'll have to have another time, but the two of you have devotion that night, just before you go to sleep. He said, one of the side benefits of this is the fact that if there's a problem during the day, and if there is anger back and forth between the two of you, what you're going to find is that it's impossible for you to read devotions and pray together while there are still some hurt feelings. He says, now, I'm not going to promise you that you're never going to have an argument or you're never going to have hurt feelings. He said, but what I am going to promise you is it might be 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning before you ever get to sleep, because you've got to work those out, because you've got to have these devotions, because that's just a part of your daily life. And Arlene and I have been able to follow that to this day. And then when those devotions are finished and I've got that quiet time with my Lord, and I'm thinking about what He, through Christ, has done for me. But see, Arlene isn't in on this, and you guys aren't in on this. It's just me and my God. Because only I and my God know who I really am. I've got some secret sins that I don't share with anybody except my God. And when I begin to think about what God through Christ has done for me, knowing who I am, then I in turn am filled with the joy and the excitement of what God through Christ has done for me, to the point that I want to share this then with you. And this is the approach that I like to use in my evangelism methods, and I teach Kennedy methods. I teach Beach and Paul methods. But my number one goal whenever I run anyone in a group through these type of methods, the number one goal is that they can achieve, maybe for the first time in their life, the same feeling that I have, to really and truly appreciate what God through Christ has done for me. And that they too might finally be able to see this. Maybe they have before, but a lot of times they've never really gone through it in that type of a process. And then when that happens, and when that carries across, and then when you begin to meet people on the street, and I love people, okay? Those of you who know me well, the only way to shut me up is to put a cup of coffee in my mouth. But I love people. But what I can do, and what I allow this to carry across, is the fact that I haven't met you yet. I've seen you, but I haven't met you. Not real. But I already know, before I begin to talk to you, before I begin to make picking holes as to where you belong, is that that same Jesus who died for me also died for you. And before we even start speaking, there's a mutual contact that you and I have got. Now possibly I've got to look for other bridges. Maybe we don't speak the same language. That's what happened when I went to New Guinea. Maybe we don't have the same likes and dislikes. Maybe we don't think the same morally and ethically and in our ethics and this type of thing. But we've got this one common bridge that the same God loved both of us so much that He sent His Son to die for me as well as for you. And so here with anybody you ever meet anywhere, you've got this one common bridge to build on. And so this, for me, has said there are people out there who haven't heard of their Savior yet. What can I do about it? Now, I can only make so many evangelism calls a month and a week and a day and a month. Well, then, of course, the best way to get this done is to enlist others in the congregation to become just as excited over what God through Christ has done for them as I am, so that all of us then can make this type of a difference. Another thing that I do differently than what you might do, and I didn't do it at first, I learned it by mistake, the transition in the Highlands when they had to build the building first. By the time the building was done, we had people ready to go into it. The first thing that I do is not to have church there. And this is possibly what happens, you know, when some of you graduate and when you get a call to a district to start a new congregation and they give you the map and they say, Lord bless you, and that's it. You're going to say, why is that? And you're going to look back in your training and you're going to say, how did church that? Well, you know, what you've been trained to do? Not that this is wrong, but are you ready for a church service? How many people are going to be there? Normally about 6 or 8 or 9 or something like that. Now what I learned is meet with people in your home and then ask another family to come and then ask another family to come. Before you know it, you're too big for that home. And you break the group in two, and then you've got two groups going, and two homes, and two different nights. And then you've got three groups going, and then you've got four groups going, and then you try on different occasions to, if you're lucky enough in the summertime, to have a picnic or get together and allow these groups to meet in the mix. And so that by the time you have this first church service, and then what you've done is you've talked to these people ahead of time, in groups, and spend a lot of time with them alone, and talk to them about the reason for the church. The reason we're starting a church is for the unchurched. The number one thing involved in the whole life of our church is mission and is outreach. And then you don't end up into a maintenance ministry right off the bat. And you make a very large thing out of this first church service. And you get a tremendous amount of publicity. You get things in the paper. You get the people excited about it. If there are neighboring congregations in the church, you get them equally excited. And then you start the first church service with 100 to 150 people. Now that's not only better for you as the person who's starting it, and it's not only better for those that are there, but it's, I think, a better witness to the community around. Hey, this is a real group. This is not somebody who's struggling. I ran across something that the very district put out, and I'd like to read a couple of points to you, and then I think we'll quit and throw it open for some questions. Is it time for a new mission? This is taken from a magazine called Mission Alert, February of this year issue. I'm familiar with some of them, but I've never seen them put down like this before. They ask some questions. Is your church located in a place where the ratio of Lutherans to population is less than it was 10 years ago? Or are the present Lutheran churches about the same size they were 20 years ago? What they're saying is you've leveled off. And then you take the church growth principle, if you're not growing, you must be dying. And you say, all right, we've got to have new growth. Is the seating capacity of your church been reached? And are you talking about a new building? Maybe it's time to talk about giving birth to a daughter. Because this fits in with one that's down number 6. Are there natural barriers that divide the community, such as rivers, freeways, railways, industry, etc.? And what they're talking about here is the unchurched. And now I'm going to really get on my soapbox. Okay. Those souls that we want the most, when we look at the three parables in Luke, the lost sheep, and the lost coin, and the lost son, they're a different breed. They're non-Christian. They're non-Lutheran. They will not, an unchristian person will not cross a major geographical barrier to come to your church. Okay? Unless you and the Holy Spirit have worked faith in his heart and his home. But on a general invitation witness, if they've got to drive out of town, they won't go. If they have to cross a natural geographic barrier, they won't go. If you don't have enough parking spots for them, they won't come. They'll turn around and drive off, I guarantee you. And don't look down on them for this. Recognize them where they're at the moment. They don't know their Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I don't think this is demeaning to the gospel in one bit to say that the people that we're trying to reach are different than we are. They're still the same in the fact that the same Jesus died for them and died for me. But the rest of their values are different than ours. And you have to start from that premise, I think. Now let me throw in one more suggestion on the same subject. Please, when you start a mission church, don't put a sign up right next to the best parking spot and say reserved for pastor. And next to that, reserved for assistant pastor. And next to that, reserved for organist. Pick out the 10 or 15 best parking spots that you've got. Right by the door, right by the end of the driveway, the best ones there, and put a sign up on each and every one of them, reserved for visitors. And talk to your congregation and say, we're going to have a new rule. The first car here parks in the furthest corner of the parking lot. So if church starts at 9, and those of you who want to be here at 8:30, you can get the thermostat set, and the flowers fixed, and everything ready for our worship service that it can be smooth and truly praiseworthy to God, you park as far away as you possibly can. You know, that's exactly the opposite of what we do, isn't it? Why do people go to church at 8:30 when it starts at 9? They can get a good parking spot. But let's turn it around and say, these best spots are reserved for visitors. You know, really make them feel welcome. There's a church in, I think it's in Trent, Michigan, that anybody who's on the paid staff or who's on the elected staff is not even allowed to use the parking lot. They have to walk, they have to be there 40 minutes early and park off in suburban neighborhoods and then walk as much as 8 blocks to get to church. When's another time to start a new congregation? The congregation's decision makers have been there for 7 years or more with few new leaders. The time to start? There are growing residential areas and an increasing number of single-parent families. I'll just talk a minute for what I have classified as first home families and second home families. It has been my experience that when people are in an area of change within their life, their spiritual life is also very wide open to change. A new job, a new marriage, a new baby, a new house, and this last congregation that I was involved with in the Highlands, everybody up there fit all four of them. Okay? I never talked to a soul in 2.5 years that was over 32 years old. And they all, it was their very first home. They've been married 2 or 3 years. They just moved out of an apartment, probably because they just had a new baby, and quite frequently because They had a new job and they finally could afford the down payment on the house. These people are wide open to the gospel because everything else in their life is seen. And this especially is the time to look for this. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't talk to other people, but I have found it much, much more difficult when people are in what I call the second family home. The youngest of the children are now 14 or 15 or 16. They want a bigger house. They can afford a bigger house. And quite a few patterns within their life have been set possibly almost in concrete. And the only time you've got to go after them then, really, is the fact that they moved into this second home. I'm a missionary. I used to have that on my business card. When you throw this in, when you get out, don't buy a cheap business card. Please, don't get one made in a men's wrap shop. Spend money for a very good, well-printed business card. And if you're starting a new mission, spend hundreds of dollars on decent, well-done signs and printing of a brochure with your picture on it. Don't mimeograph that, okay? Because this is the appearance that you're giving to people. Sure, it's going to cost $200, $300, $400, $500 to get it done right. But do it. And have a business card. And put something on it. I have the picture of the dove, the symbol that we use for the Holy Spirit on mine. And you wouldn't believe the people that would ask me, you know, what does that mean? Somebody said, what's this chicken in your car? So you said chicken? No. But, you know, you've got a road, you've got something there that they want to talk about. You've got to love people. You've got to want to find out who these people are, what their joys are, what their sorrows are. You've got to know people by their first name. You've got to know their kids. You've got to go to their house and spend some time with them. And in the mission church, you can do this. I was involved in 4 mission churches over an 8-year period, other than new babies. And there's 1 hospital call in 8 years. Never a funeral. Hey, you know, what else can you run? No shut-in calls. Because every church I started, I've been the oldest person there, other than the one that I'm working at in South Carolina. Okay, I promise some time for questions, and all the other Friday sessions that I've been to, you've never got the questions.
Okay.
You name it, in some way, my background is about it. I told you first. When I'm in an area, I browbeat the agent there, and I tell him I want a listing of everybody who is on your roll within this certain zip code number, or these 2 certain zip code numbers. And, sometimes it takes a little pressure, but you can get it. Now, it doesn't mean religion, it doesn't mean the Christian, but you know, somewhere along the line, it had something to do with Luther, okay? Don't spend a lot of time on service. If you really want to know how many unsearched are in an area, call Roger Lehner's at the International Center, and he'll tell you. Every county in the U.S., he'll tell you. As of 1980, and that's only 4 years ago. So don't use up a lot of people finding out whether there are any heathen in the neighborhood, whether we could find churches. Okay. If you want to use surveys for other reasons, yeah, go ahead. Another thing that I think you should do is check with other denominations and other pastors is part of getting to know the community and find out how many people they've got. That still didn't answer your question. Sometimes, just a couple times, twice, the district simply thought this would be a church there and once would be a tent. But you can always find the names of a family or two. And that's really about all you need. I never really started with, usually around 3 to 5 families is my hardcore nucleus. And I spent quite a bit of time with them and got each of those families to agree to starting a home Bible study in their home. And at first, we had all of them one, and then at first, there were 2 big ones. We were number 2 families, we were the 2. It's amazing how many requests you'll do in the district office. And we're a family, and here we are out in Fairbanks, and we're isolated, and what can you do to help? You don't need that much there. What you'll also find is a lot of lost people. One of the fastest growing churches that was started in the Nebraska district was in the bedroom community of Omaha, and we went from 0 to over 1,000 in about 10 years, and we had 7 adult confirmations during the community. It was a solid cancer. But not from the Omaha area, but from Kansas and Western Nebraska and South Dakota and this type of thing. And it went into a brand new residential area. And, not putting the pastor down, that he only had 7 adult confirmants in 10 years, because anybody could simply just handle transferring in 1,000 people in 10 years. It was more than busy. But here again, the Lord could tell that we were going to have this influx of people coming. Okay, my premise is to start the church and have it there waiting for them when they get there. And this is where you've got to spend an awful lot of your time is in demographics. What has been the growth of this area in the past? What is it now? And you check with city and county and state people. Check to the highway department. What are they planning for highways in the next 10 years for this area? And they don't do this on a haphazard basis. They check into some very reliable facts to see what they anticipate the population growth to be in that area, in the next 10 years. And when I was working on the Highlands, I needed to know, because in my initial calling, I was getting a lot of responses to educational things for this area, and I needed to know the number of school-age children, and I couldn't find this out from the city public schools because some of them were bused here and some of them were bused here and this type of thing. So for every afternoon for about 10 days, I would follow one of the different school buses and sit there and write down who was getting off the bus, and about the 3rd day, the cops came after me, because some lady saw me doing this and knew I was a child molester, and called the cops, and I said, no, I'm trying to tell her who I was and what I was trying to do. Fine, okay, no problem, but you've got to think of different ways to get to what you want. Does that help you? Yeah? Anyone else? Nebraska is a very Lutheran state, very Lutheran. And I would say 50% or better were Lutheran when the congregation was formed. I would say about 20% of that was quote-unquote good Lutheran, and about 30% of that was what I terminate lost Lutheran. Okay? they haven't been active, they were moving, they were in college, they got married. And here again, this other point that I have been, you know, they're open to change because of a new house, a new marriage, a new baby, a new type of thing. And if they haven't been in church in 7 years, you've got the question, okay? You can't judge, but you've got the question. Six, 8 months. And this bothers the mission boards in the district. You know, come on, Jim, what are you doing? And you're going to have church service. How many people you got? And it used to drive me up the wall when I would go to church at Lincoln. And I took this for about the first 3 months. Every month, the brethren was coming new money to get, coming new people to get. And finally, I got up the nerve after about 4 or 5 months of this. I got two. How many did you get? Oh, I'm not a mission priest. You've got to put up with it. After about 5 years, they finally accepted me. They found out I really wasn't going to steal their members. And a new congregation was good for the growth of the focus. Yeah. I don't know what the district should do with it. I think there's advantages and disadvantages to both ways, okay? What made it neat for me before as a lay minister is they couldn't give me the call, okay? You know, no questions about it. In a year and a half from now, they can. They have the right to give me the call. Because, you know, a congregation can call anybody they want. They can call Dr. Bowman. And after I start my next one, even though I went in there saying, I'm not going to stay with you, maybe the Lord will change my mind. I don't know. If we're serious about this whole thing, we need to be starting at a minimum 200 congregations a year. At a minimum. We might get 70 this year, okay? If we're really serious about this. Pastor Lenert, who is in charge of North American missions at the International Center, has challenged us to 500. In the convention at 79, which was, you know, the year of the 80s, the decade of the 80s was supposed to be the decade for missions. They came up with some pretty good sized overseas figures, which in 84 we finally began to kind of nibble at it. They had some pretty amazing figures for North American missions as well, and we're not doing that well. I think we've got to change a lot of concepts before we can really get serious on this. One, and here's what I'm sticking my neck out, dude, don't write all this down, okay? Now, does every Missouri Synod Lutheran Church have to have 10 acres of land? Does every Missouri Synod Lutheran Church have to have a building which includes a nave with pews? You know, my answer to that is no. Okay? I think the 11th commandment should be, thou wilt not build a nave with pews. We simply can't do it. You cannot build a nave furnished the way we want our church to be today to keep 200 or more people for less than $500,000. It can't be done. You use it 5 hours a week. Once you screw those pews to the floor, we're talking 5, 6, 7 hours a week, and that's it. even if you have Bible study in there, and that's a horrible place to have Bible study. You know, I don't think God gets upset if pastor gives communion in this square foot of floor space on Sunday morning, and the youth are standing there serving the volleyball Sunday night. I don't think that bothers God, okay? Especially if you really think about it and plan out and put the altar and all of that type of stuff away and bring something else in. But don't do it in a haphazard way. And don't do it in a, well, this is just until we can afford the need. You know, the congregation actually goes in and says, we're going to use multi-purpose floor plan. And if you go to an architect and you say, this is what we want, you know? This is what we want to do in this building. X number of people, we want to do these things, and we want it multi-purpose. You know, I think we've got to get rid of that a church has got to be these type of church and stuff. I personally feel it's a very poor stewardship of the Lord's money to build me. You know, we've always, for how many years have we been wanting to build a chapel here? At least we have chapel in the day. We don't have church in the day. Does every Missouri Synod pastor, I said land, I said building, you know, with me. Does every Missouri Synod church have to have its own pastor? A lot of people are saying, let's build larger churches. I don't think so. That, to me, is not what church growth is. You know, 5,000, 6,000. Unless you are so highly organized that you've properly broken it down into small cell groups or small congregations of 200 and you've got 8 or 10 or 12 staff persons. My wife has heard it so much, she doesn't want to hear it again. And Arlene and I mention her name a lot. When we did those other churches, I made very few calls that she wasn't with me. Of course, my children are all grown and married and gone. Anyway. A lot. As the Spirit moved me, really. When I was doing the congregation in Redmond, it was 50 miles away from where I lived, and I didn't want to, I thought I would commute, which I'll never do again. Next time I'll move. And I had something to do up there in the morning, and the confirmation maybe in the afternoon, and the gals, I mean, I had something going on at night, and the gals in the congregation got so used to me that they were not at all offended if I'd call them on the phone and ask them what they were having for supper, and then I'd pick out the one that I liked the best, you know, really. And I was just a part of their family, and I could stop in at any time. You know, here I am. Hi, Dick, how are you? You know, and you really get close to these people. Yeah, it depended on the people. I had some rural people. Two of them were mixed. Suburban, and they were far enough out in suburbia that I had some rural people. And, you know, at the same time, when you go up to the guy in the farm, you put your bib overalls on and go help him make hay. Really. I did not always wear a tie. I spent a lot of time selling myself and the whole idea of the congregation of the community. You could visit the mayor, you could visit the town council, or you could go down to City Hall.
You go to the newspaper and
don't pay for advertising the newspaper. People don't read it because it ends up on the church page, and it's horribly expensive. What you do is go to the religious editor, and if she's not excited about you as a person, if you bug her enough, he or she will eventually write a story about you and get a picture in and what you're doing. And this is the type of advertising you need. So. The goals I set for moving on were worship services of a minimum of 6 months, constitution written, which gave them in their basic administrative structure. I probably can claim a record. I've been involved with 5 constitutions in the past 7 years. And I doubt if anybody else can say that. Constitution, if possible, have them as a member of Synod and District, incorporated, all of that legal kind of stuff. At least thinking about location, if they haven't already worked through that. And into education and outreach programs. I normally don't let them get too much involved in men's club and ladies' aid and structured formal things at that early in the game because, hey, you're talking a voters meeting once a month. You're talking not that many people. Very heavy on fellowship. Very heavy on fellowship. Toddler, anytime you find a reason, you've got some kind of fellowship, but you're getting work done, and you're letting them get to know each other as people so that they can work together as a single unit. One of the other things I've always done is we don't have, to start with, and you're trying to say this to the community too, that we don't have a real definite time, you know, Sunday school at 9, church at 10:30. I think that church is better first, because that way if the family is there for worship, then they can't even stay until Sunday school at 9. And you talk about worship at 9, followed by fellowship, and then Sunday school and Bible class for all ages. And at first, you don't really put a time down for the Sunday school. You can afterwards, and you'll be forced into it because you're going to find people eventually who just in the neighborhood who want to send the kids to Sunday school. And constantly be thinking of ideas as to various methods of getting the people to hear the word, where the Holy Spirit has got a better chance to get his work done, other than in the form of church service. One of the things we did in the Highlands, the first Christmas we were there, was we put out flyers and we said, Mom and Dad, do you want some time where the two of you can go Christmas shopping by yourself without the kids? And this Saturday before Christmas from 1 to 5, and on this Saturday before Christmas from 1 to 5, we will provide free babysitting at Highlands Lutheran to drop the kids off. Hey, went over like a house of fire. People loved it. Not everybody who dropped the kids off eventually came to church, but you've got to say these type of things to the community. And you've constantly got to be doing that type of stuff. Okay, 12 o'clock. Thanks for having me, and I'll catch questions later.